Good afternoon. We are in Iyyoh Perek Tes Zayin, Job chapter 16. Last time we began the chapter, and what I am aiming to do today is actually to complete this speech of Job, which is the rest of chapter 16 plus chapter 17. Ambitions are important, you know. It's good to have goals. So, yeah. So, again, we began this chapter, which was his response to Eliphaz. We began with his rejection of Eliphaz's words as foolish and uncomprehending. Eliphaz was the one who had said to him in the speech immediately before this that Job is wicked, that he diminishes righteousness, that Job is arrogant, and he had made the claim that wicked people suffer. So Job responds that his words are foolish, they lack comprehension, and then he launched into a speech which began in chapter 16, sentence 6, if you're using the art scroll, you're on page 1641, in which he said, God has crushed me, and he discusses different levels in which God has crushed him. In sentences 7 and 8, he talks about God wearing him out, destroying him, creasing, crumpling, wrinkling him. I think of the instructions in the mail, right? Do not spindle, fold, or mutilate. So Job is checking all the boxes for what God has done to him. We talked about trial by ordeal a little bit. But then the last thing that we saw was chapter 16, sentence 9, in which, in addition to describing the harm that God has inflicted on him, he also ascribes emotion and will to God. More than saying God has destroyed him, he says God hates him. He says in sentence 9, Apo taraf vayistemeni charak alai bishinav tsari yiltosh enav li. Apo taraf, his anger tore me up specifically. And he says, Charak alai b'shinav, he gnashed his teeth at me, or he ground his teeth at me. Tsari, my enemy, yiltosh einav li, flashes his eyes at me. So he has switched to third person regarding God, right? We talked about that last time, how he goes back and forth in this chapter between second person and third person, addressing God directly versus speaking about God. But he describes God as hating him. He describes God as his enemy. And I mentioned last time that Rashi is so taken aback by this that Rashi says, and was noted last time that it fits some of the wording in this, some of the language, like the word vayistemeni, that he's actually talking about not God, but the Satan as his enemy. The problem with that is that Job doesn't know the beginning of the book. He doesn't know anything about that story. That's a very difficult thing for him to be saying. But what does he mean when he calls God his enemy? What are we talking about here? What does it mean for God to be somebody's enemy? What does that mean to you when someone declares God as his enemy, Susan?
Well, I think from what we see, first of all, God is his enemy toward, in the sense that what I do, so you're punishing me so much, you must hate me, therefore you're my enemy, but you're an enemy I can't fight against. But to do this to me, you're not my friend, you're not my helper, you're not someone I can depend on, which is opposite of what you were supposed to be involved, but rather someone who's out to get me, which is a very negative connotation.
Okay.
As my enemy.
Okay. If there's a trial, and the judge finds the person guilty, or the jury finds the person guilty, and they sentence the person to whatever it is, are they the person's enemy?
No.
No. They're representative of the justice system. And the justice system is not the person's enemy. The person broke the law and then is going to suffer the results. It is more than just calling God the judge.
But he doesn't see God as a judge, I don't think, in here. He sees God's God beyond.
And that's exactly
God to the point of like he's taking this personally. He's not judging me, he's just against me.
Right. So there's more than just calling God a judge. That's piece number one. Ari.
Well, it's assuming that God takes sides and has emotions.
Yeah, very much so. He is absolutely ascribing emotion to God. That's a very difficult thing theologically within Judaism, the whole question of whether God has emotions or whether we simply ascribe them to God based on what we perceive of divine actions. In other words, God does something that looks like what I would do if I was angry or if I was merciful. Therefore, God is merciful, God is angry, and so on. It's more my language than it is a description of God. Keeping in mind that Job, of course, is not necessarily Jewish and doesn't have to be following any of those rules, he could actually mean it when he says God is his enemy. But he's absolutely assigning emotion and intent to God. And it's not just that God is allowing me to be harmed. It's so strong. It's God is actively working against me. Joyce, and then you check. Yeah.
An enemy is something who wants to destroy you.
Oh, yeah.
It's much more than just being judgment. He wants to destroy you.
Yep. Very much so. You check.
I think your analogy of the court sort of fits in with this. What you say is if you're in front of a corrupt court, they're supposed to be absolutely impartial, but they are not. They're corrupt. And I think that's effectively what he's saying about Shemaiah.
So yeah.
The judgment is corrupt. This is not based on any fair standard.
Based on
that, and you can call it a big thing if you want. But really, it's a bunch of criminals.
Right, but even within that, Yishai notes the possibility that he's saying it's a court, but it's a corrupt court. But keep in mind that at least when there's corruption, we know what the motivation is. Right? In other words, the judge was bribed by somebody on the other side of my case. Or, you know, the judge has an agenda. The judge is running for office and wants to build a track record or whatever it is. There is some motivation for the judge. Job has no motivation he can assign to God other than, boy, he just hates me. He's just, yeah, it's, there's no explanation for it. It's simply so. Professor.
It's a reflection of his emotional state more than it is a condemnation of God. In the sense that that's how he feels put upon. He feels a sense of despair and a sense of having suffered unjustly. And he's in a state of turmoil.
Turmoil for sure. Feeling like he's suffering unjustly, absolutely. The only thing I would say is that, you know, Job is not of the species that begins their sentences with "I think" or "I feel." He makes assertions. It may be his personal perspective, but as far as he's concerned, it's a statement of fact. So I think this to me is a major leap from where he has been. Until now, he has spoken a great deal about injustice, but never has he made it so personal as he does here. Eliphaz has pushed him another step by the condemnations that he's given, but he's not done. Take a look at sentences 10 and 11, please. He says, again, if you're working with the art scroll, Stone Tanakh, excuse me, you want the bottom of page 1641. He says, Paru alai bifihem. They opened up their mouths against me. Becherpa hiku lechayai. In shame, or creating shame, really, they struck my jaw, they slapped me. Yachad ala yismalaun. Together, they raise themselves up against me. They gather against me. Yasgireni kel el avil. God gives me into the hands of a tyrant. Val yedei reshaim yirteini. And via wicked people, he knocks me down. When sentence 10, Pasuk Yud, began with the plural, did that throw you off a little bit?
Yes, I was wondering
who is they?
Yes.
Technically, who are they? But you know what I mean. They, who?
Three people. That doesn't make sense.
So who is it?
The tribunal.
What tribunal? Is it? Is he talking about his visitors? Have they slapped him? Verbally, but certainly not physically. This is not simple and straightforward. It could be it refers to the visitors. It could be it refers to the attackers. Remember that some of his suffering came at the hands of invaders. It wasn't just act of God in the sense of a bolt of lightning, but there were human beings who were involved as well. It could be a generic statement. I feel besieged by people, even though no one has actually besieged him. But the overall theme that I see here is not only is God against me, not only has God harmed me, not only does God hate me, but in addition to that, he's rallying others against me. It's not enough for God that he should dislike me and use his formidable powers against me, but he's rallying the troops against me.
Isn't that the typical Jewish way? They're all anti-Semitic.
Well, when, you know, you're not paranoid if they really are out to get you. I think what there is, connecting back to what he said to them, when, remember that Job said, we read it last week, that if they were in his shoes, he would be compassionate. He would join himself with them. And now he's saying, I am entirely isolated. Not only is God against me, but God has turned everybody else against me too. If only, by the way, he has made me suffer, which people take as demonstration of my guilt. God has rallied everybody else against me. None of them are on my side, and so there is none of there's none of the empathy that I wanted. That's what Job is saying. There's no one on my side. They're all here to attack me. And so he concludes the thought in Psukim Yud Bet Tiyud Dalet, sentences 12-14. He says, God has destroyed my person, my body. Shalev hayisi vayefarfereini. There are some great words in this sentence. The Hebrew speakers will enjoy it. I can welcome back Ora now. She'll enjoy this one. The Shalev hayiti vayefarfereini v'achaz be'orpi vayefatz pitzeini. Even if you don't know Hebrew, you can hear the sounds of it. I was at peace, and then vayefarfereini. What does the word vayefarfereini mean? Don't read an English translation. What does the word vayefarfereini mean?
Shake.
To shake? Butterfly. Thank you. Butterfly in Hebrew is a parpar. Right. Precisely. The vayefarfereini, he has shaken me. He has made me flutter. I don't know, what do they translate this with? Now we can take a look.
Shattered.
Broke me asunder. They broke me into pieces. I'm going to go with the butterfly. But the image is of being broken apart. It's true. The word in Hebrew for crumbs is perurin. So it could be associated with crumbling. But I like that image, the butterfly image. Ve'achaz be'arpi, he grabbed me by the scruff of my neck. Vayefatz pitzeni, another fantastic word. It's to smash. Lefotzeitz.
They use that today in the army.
Yeah? It's an explosion.
Yeah.
Yes. So the he's describing utter and complete harm. Vayikimeni lo lamatara. He made me a target, as in target practice. He shoots his arrows at me. Yasobu alai rabav. And not only God himself, but once again, other parties are involved. His rabav, I think, does not mean here great people like Rav, but rather like Roveh, a shooter, one who shoots. So they surround me. Those who shoot surround me. The hunters surround me. And Don Mikra takes it that way. Yifalach kil yosai velo yachmol. He will split my kidneys. And he will have no mercy. Yishpoch la'aretz mirei rasi. He spills out my bile onto the ground. Complete and total devastation of his person inside and out. And then he crushes my spirit as well. I'm not done with this section yet. He's still one more on the body. Yifritzeini feretz al pene paretz. He breaks me open. Notice the play on words again. Yifritzeini peretz al pene paretz. He breaks me open with break after break, with split upon split. Yarutz alai kagibor. Either he crushes me or he runs up to me, either way, like a warrior. He's describing God as mercilessly attacking, crushing, rallying troops against him, laying him waste. And then he says, he describes the destruction of his spirit as well to conclude this section. Sak tafarti ale gildi ve'olalti ve'afar karni. He says, I stitched sackcloth on my geled. Geled is a scab. The scab. Remember that he had boils? That was what was his second round of suffering. So he says, I've stitched sackcloth upon my skin where I am wounded. Ve'olalti ba'afar karni. And I rub my horn in the dust. Now, Job does not have horns. Michelangelo, with a statue of Job, if there was one, would not have put horns on him. He had enough trouble. But the image of a horn is what? What is a horn?
Pride.
Pride. Right. Karen is often used that way. V'yareim Karen Mishicho. It is also a shofar, a trumpet used to signify victory. Ramakarni Bashem, right. It's an expression of pride. And he says, my pride is in the dust. It's rolling in the dust. Panai chamar meru mini vechi. My face, chamar meru is a very interesting word. Chamar in Hebrew is clay. In Arabic, according to Dat Mikra, chet mem resh is a term for redness. The idea of a red clay, perhaps. Panai chamar meru, my face is like this red clay from crying, mini bechi. And that term chamar meru is also used in Eicha, right? Me'ai chamar meru, in Lamentations. Li'al af apai tzalmaves, and the shadow of death, he says, is upon my eyes. So not only is he physically destroyed, but he is devastated personally. His pride is rolling in the dust. He's left sort of just like stitching his, sackcloth over his wounds. His face is destroyed, ravaged by tears. He has death upon his eyes. And of course, the image of death upon one's eyes, we associate with closing the eyes of the person who passed away. He's got nothing. And the image of the eyes also may well be associated with what you look up with for hope, I suppose. The eyes are usually looking towards hope. So he says, this is what God has done to me. He has gotten rid of my supporters. He has turned on me as an enemy and crushed me inside and out. But, he says, and this is the next section here with which he completes this chapter, he says, I'm innocent. I haven't done whatever it is that God thinks I've done. And so I demand justice from God. And here in this section, we're going to see it so clearly. We're going to see him use terms, I'll highlight them as we go through, that emphasize the call for justice. And he's the language of litigation. He says, "Alo chamas bechapai." In sentence 17, "Alo chamas bechapai usfilasi zaka." He says, "There is no chamas on my hands." And chamas, we've seen it before in this book itself. We've talked about it. We talked about it a lot last year. Chamas as violent theft, right? I never committed chamas. And chamas was a particular kind of theft, not just the violence of it, but it was associated with disrupting justice, specifically. I never disrupted justice, God. Maybe you did. But I have never disrupted justice, right? We talked about it was thwarting the justice system. A person stole less than the court would be willing to try a person for. And it was a longer discussion then. But he says, I am not guilty of anything like that, and tfilasi zaka. My prayer is pure. I want to come back to that clause in a second. Yishai, what were you going to ask or say?
I think the sense on the last page, in the middle of his condemnation, I think he's actually saying something really nice where he talks about the sackcloth.
Yeah.
I think what he's saying is, look, I do think it's unfair. I do think it's unjust. But I still did tshuva. I still accepted it. Because why am I wearing a sackcloth on these wounds, right? He's saying, look, even while he's punishing me, I'm doing tshuva and it's not enough.
Interesting.
There's, I think, a longing there for redemption, despite his cynical...
So, the fundamental question would be, Yishai is suggesting that sackcloth is a sign of repentance. And we do see that in the book of Jonah, for example, where they don sackcloth. That's true. But here it sounds to me like it's this very low-grade material that he's using to shield his wounds. Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I would want to see, what it would really require is to look through the book and see how sock in general is used. And see whether there's any evidence of it being used that way in general. I think it's an interesting question. But what is this business about tefillah si zaka? First of all, anybody know what tefillah zaka is? Before Yom Kippur, right. It's a prayer that is found in the machzor, most machzorim, for right before Yom Kippur begins, in which a person asks God for forgiveness for various sins committed with different limbs of the body, and it's called tefillah zakah, which means a pure prayer. It's actually pulled right from here.
That's not the normal word for pure.
Yeah, zach. This is the feminine form of zach, and zach is pure. Tahor is usually a ritual purity. Zach is usually a physical purity. So, for example, the oil for the menorah, shemen zayit zach. The zechut is from the same root. When we talk about a zechus or a zechut, it's the same root. So, but he's saying my prayer is pure. Now, the problem that I have as I read this clause, which causes me to pause here, is... what is a pure prayer, number one? What does that mean? Is there a prayer that's not pure? And number two, since when is Job praying? Is he saying, I used to pray purely when I brought the offerings? Maybe. I don't know. All along, he's been refusing to pray. When he was told to pray, he said, I'm going to turn to God, all right, but I'm not turning to God with prayer. I'm turning to God with allegations. So my prayer historically was pure. Okay, let's say we take that. What is a pure prayer as opposed to an impure prayer?
Everyone says pure conscience.
Sorry?
In the definition of my prayer is pure, if he did so with a pure heart, clear conscience.
Ah, so the prayer came from innocence within me, within, maybe. I think we can do more with it. Unconditional prayer. In other words, I turn to God not demanding, as opposed to this book anyway, but I turn to God not demanding, but it was simply a communication with God. Maybe. I don't think that asking God for something is impure.
No, neither do I.
So why impute that here? As opposed to?
Mm-hmm. What he's saying is, Shem Shemayim, I went in there, I was focused on the praying, I wasn't focused on me, I wasn't focused on what the weather was, it was me and God, right?
Right. Now that's... So the idea of the prayer being just me and God. It's interesting. Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler, on this line, says, I never mixed in an inappropriate thought. My kavanah, my intention was pure. To which I respond, that is entirely... out of context in this book. I mean, to talk about kavana, to talk about your focus, when you're dealing with a protagonist or antagonist, depending on how you look at him, who doesn't even want to talk to God, generally speaking. It's sort of like you have somebody who has no interest whatsoever in religion. And you're going to say, make sure when you get food for dinner, make sure you get the food with the proper hechsher on it, with the proper certification on it. Like, wrong ballpark. Wrong topic. Why, what, out of nowhere, Job is going to be talking at the level of his concentration in the in prayer? I find that difficult, and the commentators, other commentators provide other approaches. Take a look, please, at source number one. Rashi gives us the following. Lo kilalti chaverai, or chaveri, velo pilalti lo ra'a. I never cursed a friend. I never prayed for anybody to be harmed. That's an interesting statement. I never wished harm on anybody. I sort of wonder if that's not a knock on his friends who, in justifying the harm that's happening to him, are essentially praying for harm for him. I wonder if that's a little bit of what's going on here.
But who's he kidding? Who's so pure that they've never had impure thoughts about others?
I would ask the question further. He's claimed to be perfect all along, and I believe he has been claiming, to be perfect, not just to be, generally a good guy. He has called himself Tum, which is a high standard. So this is par for the course. Yeah. Well, he happens to be right. That's a separate point. So maybe he has never wished harm upon anybody else. It could be. I think that what Rashi's statement here, and Ralbag has it too, what I think it has going for it is that it's consistent with the other half of the sentence. Right? When we're stuck with a clause like this, from a skills perspective, when we approach verses in Tanakh, if I have a clause like this that I don't understand, the first thing I should do is look at the first half of the sentence and see what it informs me about the second half. So the first half of the sentence said, I haven't done chamas. I haven't committed violence towards anybody. That's on a physical level. And in my prayers to God, I never wished harm upon anybody, is what Rashi and Ralbag are seeing here. So I've been good towards others all along. And that's one way to take it. Malbim has yet another way. He says, Zakai, as in is Zakai, to be victorious. I will be victorious with this prayer of mine. But I like what Rashi and Ralbag have done here. I think it makes sense within the context. And he's saying, all of this, God's enmity, all of the suffering, all of the depression that this has brought me, for what? I didn't hurt anybody. I never wished harm on anybody. And so he says, Pasuk Yud Chet, sentence 18, one of the most powerful lines in this book. Eretz al techasi dami. He calls out to the land, do not cover my blood. This is a line that gets used in the various versions of the Kelmale, of the memorial prayer. Eretz al techasi damam. Let the land not cover the blood of the innocent. He says it about himself. Eretz al techasi dami. Do not cover my blood. Va'al yihi makom lezaakasi. Let there be no place where my cry will be hidden. Gam ata hine bashamayim edi. Vesahadi bamiromim. He says, my testimony is in the heavens. My testimony is of both words, Shemayim and Romim. Shemayim, sky, and Romim are heavens. The testimony to the veracity of my claim is up there in the heavens. These two sentences have said an awful lot. He has done a ton with these two sentences. And with these two sentences, I realize, yeah, there's no way we're going to finish chapter 17. Because we have to understand what he has done here. First of all, you hear the power of what he's saying. When he says, Eretz, it's not just me imagining it. Eretz ad chasi dami, land, do not cover up my blood. Where does that image come from in the Torah? Cain and Hevel, the very first murder. Very good. Right, well, not good, but you know what I mean. The very first murder. Kol dmei achicha tzoakim elai min ha'adama. Right? The sound of the blood of your brother is crying out to me from the earth, God says to Cain. And Job says, let the earth not cover my spilled blood. And it's not only there. I brought you, after source number 3, there's a line there, I should have made it number 4. It's 3 3/4 instead. But the reference to covering spilled blood is used elsewhere in Tanakh as well. If you take a look, it's worth looking it up. Bamidbar, Numbers, chapter 35, sentence 33. It's on your sheet. In that source that's unnumbered. Bamidbar, chapter 35, sentence 33. Sentence on page 421. This is talking about what to do if somebody commits murder, and the question of whether somebody who commits murder can escape to the city of refuge if he has killed someone intentionally. And the Jews are warned, page 421, Velo sachanifu es haaretz asher atem ba. Do not, they have as bring guilt upon, I'll take that for now, the land in which you are located, ki hadam hu yachanif es haaretz, because the blood will bring guilt upon the land, the blood of the victim. Vela aretz lo yechupar ladam asher shupach ba. The land will not find atonement for the blood spilled within it unless via the blood of the murderer. We can discuss capital punishment another time, that's not my point. The point is this idea that the blood is absorbed in the land, that does not rid the murderer of his guilt. The guilt remains and it poisons everything. And we find it as well, the next reference I gave you, Devarim Yud Tet, Yud, Devarim 19:10, it is on page 473, if you're using the stone Tanakh. Again, talks about the blood from murder, and it says, "V'lo yishafech dam naki." There it's talking about saving the person who killed someone by accident. So if his blood would be spilled, it would be dam naki. But don't let that blood be spilled, b'kerav aretzecha, in the midst of your land. One more reference. On page 997 in the Stone Tanakh, Yeshaya, Isaiah, chapter 26, sentence 21. You see the reference here about punishment being brought. V'gilasa ha'aretz es dameha. The land will reveal its blood. V'lo sechase od al harugeha, and no longer will it cover up for those who were killed there. You could actually come up with many more. If you do a search on, you know, any of the databases, you'll find many more places where there are references to the earth covering up blood, but the point is always the same. There is guilt for those who murder, and I, Job is saying, I am the innocent victim. And God, I am not going to allow you to cover up the way you've murdered me. That's what he's saying to God. He's saying, let the land not cover up my blood. I wonder about the association between this and the mitzvah of Kisui Hadam and Zrikas Hadam. There's a lot to be said about it in another time. But he's saying, the earth shall not be party to the cover-up. The earth will testify to what God has done to me. But he's not done with the earth, because look at the next sentence, Pasuk Yutet, sentence 19. The heavens as well will testify to what God has done to me. The heavens themselves are going to be my tool, not God's tool, but my tool. Now, there's more to say on that. In source number 2, I brought you 2 verses from Deuteronomy, from Devarim. There are many more. I'll say it outside, you can look it up if you like. In one of them, God says to the Jews, I call heaven and earth, God says. I call heaven and earth upon you as witnesses to this covenant and to your responsibility if you break the covenant. There are a couple such references. Sorry? Well, Hazinu is the other way. Hazinu Hashem Ba'aretz, the famous Shemayim Refi, is now that they've been made witnesses, now I'm going to address them. But yes, it's the same concept. The heaven and earth as witnesses is a very important theme within the Torah. There are many reasons why heaven and earth are used as witnesses. Why would you choose them as witnesses in particular? So one reason is that they are constants. If you take a look at source number 3, you win the prize. Rashi was behind door number 1. Rashi says, Shehem Kayamim Le'olam. They endure forever. V'kasher tikra eschem hara'ah, and so when punishment comes to you, yihyu edim shani hisrezi b'chem b'chozos, they're going to be my witnesses that I warned you about all of this, because they'll be around, and so they will testify against you. That's one explanation. Second explanation Rashi brings is that they are role models. Amar lema kadosh baruch hu Yisrael, God says to Israel, Histaklu b'shamayim shebarasi l'shamesh eschem, see the heavens I created to serve you. Shemashinu es midasam, did they ever change their attributes? Did they ever stop doing what they were doing? Shemalo Allah gal gal chama min amizrach v'heir l'chol ha'olam, tell me, does the sun stop rising in the west and illuminating the world? So the idea of calling them as witnesses is because they represent loyal service to God. Another explanation that's offered, the Chizkuni commentary from 13th century France, suggests that it's because the heavens and the earth are used in the Torah as the agents of reward and punishment. Because they specifically, whether it's a drought or whether it's a flood, you know, the heavens rain down, the waters come up from the earth below, the land not producing or the land producing very well. These are all reward and punishment. And so they are the agents. They're not only the witnesses, they're also the agents. Another idea. Heaven and earth are the first things in creation. Right? In the beginning of God's creation of the heavens and the earth. Right? That's the very beginning. So God summons them usually as witnesses. We find it classically throughout Tanakh. And Job has just kidnapped them. He has taken God's favorite witnesses and said, these are my witnesses. Let the earth not cover up the blood, or maybe your witnesses, God, shouldn't be corrupt. You can't rig the game with your expert witnesses. Let the earth not cover up my blood. The heavens have to bear testimony to what they have seen. Yes?
So, but isn't it the mark of a truly innocent person to be able to do something like this? If he was really, truly pure and didn't have blemish and didn't sin, then calling Hashem's witnesses is perfectly justifiable. But so it attests to his innocence. It's another thing in his favor.
Oh yeah.
That he.
I wouldn't say it's in his favor as much as it's a demonstration of his sincerity. He genuinely. You don't call the heavens and earth as a witness if you think you've done something wrong. Right. You're in a lot of trouble if you ask them to run the video and the video shows you deflating the football. So that's the idea is, sorry, I'm an American. The statement that he's making is, I am so sure that I am right that I'm going to call the heavens and the earth themselves your witnesses to testify and to show that I am right. I think that's very much a part of this. There's a lot you could do with this. I'm giving you a small piece of it. By the way, the phrase that he uses, Sahadi Vamromim, is found in rabbinic writings in Midrash as a statement of, this is for sure true. Sahadi Bamromim, the testimony to it is found in the heavens. So, by the way, another way you could take it is that he's actually saying God is the witness. Once he calls upon the heavens, so who's the heavens? That's God. So that's Rashi notes is another way to read it. I also wonder if this doesn't tie into the whole astrology discussion. The constellations themselves are testimony to the way this game is rigged against me. So there's a whole lot you can. This line is such a loaded. These two sentences are such a loaded pair of sentences. Sorry. But there's more. There's still more here. So he has said, again, let's make sure we understand where he's coming from and what he's doing. He has said that he is innocent. He has said that God is crushing him before this, in body and in spirit, that God is rallying people against him to crush him. He says, I am innocent. I was innocent in my deeds with others. I was innocent in my prayer. I call heaven and earth as my witnesses. That's what he says. What he's also done here is, as I mentioned when I introduced this section, he's using the language of litigation. Right? He says, go back to these sentences. Sentence 19, he talks about edut and sahadi, which is actually, it's interesting, that's a term we usually associate in Aramaic, with testimony. And then he goes on here in sentences 20 and 21, he says, militzai rei'ai el eloka dalfa eini. This first clause is a very difficult clause to render. Militzai rei'ai. Literally, you would render it as, my agents who will argue on my behalf, rei'ai, my friends. But he knows they're not at all like that. So let's see what our translations do before I add a note to it. Yeah. In the art scroll, they do, my orators, my friends. Yes. My inner thoughts are my intercessors. Okay.
I pour tears unto God.
Right. And that's the JPS edition, and Dot Mikra follows that edition as well. Right, but I'm saying that the JPS follows that as well. What do you have, Debbie?
Which just falls off. Testify, witness.
Correct.
All the legal words.
Right. And that's exactly what's going on. But the idea that essentially what he's saying is, I don't need you. My arguments are my friends, so to speak. My eyes tear toward God. But it's this language of advocacy, consistent with the language of litigation. And then he continues, V'yochach legever im eloka uven adam lireehu. He says, let me argue with God as one argues with another person. That's the way Rashi renders it. And again, lahochiach is another term that's a litigation term, to demonstrate, to prove that one is right. Rashi in source number 6, I'm coming back to Nusim in a minute, but Rashi in source number 6, he says that what Job is saying is, halavai yaseh li zos, I wish God would do this to me. She'yiteh li makom lehitvakeach gever meloka, that he would leave me a space in which to quarrel with him. Let's have it out. Lahashvot shnei rivim, he is equating two quarrels, riv gever im konov, riv ben adam l'reyehu, a quarrel between man and his creator, and a quarrel between one man and another. I want to have that same ability to defend myself to God as a person gets in court. I'm coming back to Nusim. I'm just going to read the last sentence in the section, Pasuk Chavet, sentence 22. He says, Kishnos misparia esayu, va'orach lo ashuv ehaloch. He says, because I only have numbered years remaining, I have little time left, and the path I walk, I'm never going to walk again. This is it. He says, this is my shot, and so I want to appeal to God to be able to try my case.
It had said that he wants to live, and here it occurs he wants to have to live. Yet, before he kept asking for death.
Yes.
So, that's another change in Job. From what he kept saying, God killed me, I want to die, and these pains are so terrible. And suddenly now, he's talking about living, and I'm not sure, as his pains are getting worse, why he now wants
to. So I'm actually going to come back to whether he sees himself living here in a second, because there's, I think, a point to make in that. But I think in general, he's attaching a particular purpose to the life he wants. He's not saying, I have a vision of myself surviving and flourishing and returning to society and so on. I want to live long enough, God, to see through this trial. I want to be able to carry out my litigation, and I am afraid of passing on before I'm able to do that. I don't see him desiring life in general as much as, I just want to be able to get rid of my enemy. That's really Tamos Nafshi and Plishtim. I'd rather go with the Philistines. Yeah. Take a look now at 4 and 5, please. Two notes from Newsom that I thought were interesting in this section. First of all, normally in Tanakh, when someone describes to God how he is suffering, it's a plea for aid. Right? It's usually, God, I am in misery, like King David in Psalms. I am in misery, God help me. But not here. Source number 4, Newsom points out, Job's descriptions of graphic divine violence in chapter 16 initially allude to the place of such language in prayers of supplication. It sounds like he's going to ask God for help. Whereas in Psalms of supplication, this imagery establishes both the righteous power of God, God can heal me, and the neediness of the faithful yet guilty petitioner, right? I need your help, God. Job disrupts the traditional transaction effected by such language by juxtaposing it to legal discourse with all the language here of testimony and proof and so on, as he seeks to preserve his blood and his cry as testimony to a murder, a charge to be argued by his heavenly witness, let the heavens be my witness. In other words, instead of what usually happens in Tanakh, God, I am suffering, therefore help me, it's God, I am suffering, therefore I accuse you. That's what he's doing. And then in number 5, the other note, why does he need witnesses at all? He's been very comfortable giving his own testimony all along. So he could answer, it's because he's saying, look, even the heavens and earth are my witnesses, as he said before. But take a look at what she notes here. She suggests, and this is consistent with other verses we're going to see, the necessity of giving witness becomes so strong that when he thinks of death as preventing him from bringing his accusation or defending himself, Job's imagination supplies surrogates who will speak for him. And she gives examples that we haven't yet seen besides the one that we do see here. In other words, he's calling witnesses because he's saying, I'm not going to live forever. Therefore, you should know, my testimony is put away with the heavens and the earth, and therefore, even if I go, the heavens and the earth are going to know what happened. And the case can still be prosecuted, theoretically. Yeah.
I think the EOC partly is all those things that I look back on, I thought they were really meaningful, and they're not. So this challenge, last piece of my life, if it has no meaning, life has no meaning. So I have to make sense of it as my utopia, as my purpose.
Where do you see that in what he's saying?
When he talks about the Job and Seal, he goes on to say it's going to get done, he just said.
Right, but I'm saying, what was the business about everything he had done before that he had found meaning in before now being meaningful.
Their arguments are the same arguments that he's operating based on at the beginning of the book. He's clearly operating on Eliphaz.
Right, but I'm just saying, where in these verses do you see him reject? I don't see him expressing that, really addressing that. The last several verses here in chapter 16. Yes. Right, no, but I'm saying the idea that he's saying what I did before is now...
Because this trial wasn't what he was doing before. What he was doing before was, if it was so fantastic, why didn't God destroy it? So now my only thought is, these series of destructive events are my life. And they must have a meaning, or I'm just totally...
Okay. I hear. I'm not convinced, but I hear. Let's start chapter 17. Chapter 17 reads fairly quickly, as you'll see. His opening half of the chapter, he's going to say, go back to what he had said before about being crushed, but he combines really the last two elements. He combines what has been done with him, or done to him really, with his suit against God. He says, Ruchi Chubala, we're at chapter 17, sentence 1, we're on page 1643 in the Stone Tanakh. One of the images you're going to see a lot of here is the image of eyes and vision. He says, Ruchi Chubala, my spirit is crushed, is wounded. Wounded rather than crushed, really. Yamai Nizachu, my days are crushed. Kivarim Li, there are graves for me. Why does he need more than one grave? Family? That's an interesting idea. Mitzvah David just says, it's singular in their translation?
The grave is ready for me.
The grave is ready for me. What is it? But yeah, the word in Hebrew is kvarim. Yeah, once we change it, anything goes. The Mitzvah David suggests what he's saying is, everything I see seems like a grave. You know, or everything I look at is a grave. However, I wonder, look at the sentence itself. I don't see why you can't read it this way. Ruchichu bala, my spirit is wounded, or crushed. Yamai nizachu, my days are crushed, kivarim li, and therefore his days are his grave. It's the plural from Yamai. And my days are, because even though he is alive, it is as though he is residing in the grave already. And so he sees his days as being grave-like. That's a possible read. I would also note the meter in the sentence for the Hebrew readers is very interesting. You know, until now, Job has largely stuck to the formula of couplets, right? Sentences with two halves, in which each half has several syllables. Here, Ruchichu bala, Yamai nizachu, Kvarim li, it's like he's gasping. In his suffering, each one has just these two words expressing the thought. He says, "Imlo hatulim imadi uvahamro sam talan enai." He says, "I am surrounded by scorn." He says, "I am close to death." Number one, that was sentence one, and in sentence two, aside from the fact that I have all this mocking with me, uvahamro sam talan eni, and to the sound of their mocking, or the bitterness it brings, Hamro Tam admits multiple translations, but with the sound of this mocking, Talan Eini, my eye goes to sleep. I go to sleep at night hearing what they're doing, seeing the way that they mock me. And so he says to God, Simana Arveni Imach Mihu Liadai Yitakea. He says, God, I want to litigate with you. Now, there are multiple reads for this sentence. I'm going with the Tzudat David because that's the one that I find works best to my mind with what Job has been saying in context. He says to him, Simana, God, give me your hand, Arveni Imach. What is an Arev in Hebrew? A guarantor. He says, God, I want some kind of guarantee from you, meaning that you will see through this trial. Mihu liadi yitakea, who will clasp his hand to mine? Mitzudat David on your sheets in source number 7. Chazar panav klapei amakom. Job turned his face back to God. Ve'amar, and he said, Sim ata libcha elai, laseis li arev bimekom echa. He says, God, turn your heart to me to give me a guarantor in your place, along the lines of the heaven and earth, I think. Lios batuach bo shetishalem or shetishlam hahitvakchut beinenu lavo al haemet. He says, I want to know that this trial, this litigation, is going to come to truth in the end. Umiu asher yitka yado l'toch yadi l'kabel l'atzmo b'kiyum gamur l'ashlim at hahitvakchut. Who is going to shake hands with me to accept responsibility to actually complete this litigation, God? I have a hunch, God, that you're not going to complete the litigation with me. And so he says, in sentence 4, Kilibam tzafanta misachel, alkein lo teromeim. He says, God, these visitors, these people that I have coming to me, you have hidden their hearts from wisdom. They don't get it. They don't understand. And therefore, lo teromeim, when they say things about you, that doesn't exalt you. They can't be your representatives, God. In source number 8, I brought you Mitzudat David, but it's basically what I just said. There's nothing that they can offer that will be meaningful. And he continues now to bash the visitors. He says, L'chelek yagid re'im. Chelek is when people speak very smoothly, flatteringly. Chalak, exactly. So to smooth talk, they say, that's my friend. When someone speaks smoothly, they're suckered in by that. Ve'enei banav tichlena. While the eyes of that person's children, tichlena, will be worn out, meaning lack of hope. Each of these visitors accepts smooth flattery, and the result is that his children will have no hope of help because people won't fulfill their word. V'itzigani, one second. V'itzigani l'mshol amim v'sofes l'fanim ehye. This visitor makes me a target for the mockery of the nations. They hold me up as an example. V'sofes l'fanim ehye. I am made a target for their spitting or a drum for their beating, either way. For them, one more sentence. V'atecha mikas eini. There's that I again, the third time in this section. My eye is worn out by anger. Bitsurai katzel kulam. My limbs, the parts of my body, are all like a shadow. They are all without substance. So what Job is saying, we didn't quite finish the section, but I'm going to pause with that and take the question from Susan. He says, I suffer the scorn of others. I need to litigate with God. I need to know that this is going to come to fruition, because all these visitors, they're nothing. They don't understand. They accept foolishness. What they have to say is irrelevant. I need to know that my trial with God is going to come to fruition. Susan.
It seems, from what I'm looking at, understanding, the word "ahu" is only here. And now also the meaning of, in verse 7, there was a word that only here means limbs.
Yeah, you'd see right.
How do they get, if it means ahu, could have a thousand meanings, but here it says extinct, you said crushed. How
do you deal with a hapax, is the question.
Yeah.
Right, when you have a word that only appears once in Tanakh, what do? So the answer is that in some cases, you do it by context. And you look at the words that surround it, and they can give you a hint. However, when you have a word like this, you have more assistance, which is Zayin and Dalid in ancient Near East languages often interchange, and we have Dalid Ayin Chaf as a term for crushing elsewhere. So that can often give you a clue for what's going on when you look at certain letter substitutions. What did they do here with Nizahu and Dad Mikra? They did. Oh, there. Dalet Ayin Chaf. Yeah. They say here, Nidachu, they render as Ne'ekru v'nifsaku, to be uprooted and to be cut off, is the way that they render it. And they point out that we actually saw that in chapter 6, sentence 17. We saw that other root, Bichumo Nidachu Mimakomam, was used back there. It was to be severed from its place, from where it had been. That was about streams that dried up. So we have such a root, even within the book. They also note here that in Arabic, the root Zaha, which is what we're seeing here, is used to mean something that is cut off or made to wait. So we find that concept elsewhere here. But yeah, when you have a word that only shows up once, and Eov is the repository of words that only show up once in Tanakh, then you often turn to either letter substitutions that are common in these sorts of languages, or roots as they appear in these other languages, or context in order to try to figure it out. That's how you would deal with it. So what we've seen now, again, Job has reiterated the suffering that he's experiencing. He has personalized it. God is his enemy, which I think was a major point. He has called on heaven and earth as his witnesses to his innocence and to the way that God has made him suffer. He has co-opted God's witnesses for himself. And he is now describing his great suffering and saying, God, I need to litigate with you, and these visitors, I have no interest in them at all. We're going to have to finish this chapter, God willing, next week, and move on to Bildad and Bildad's second speech. People asked me the question of